"If you've come to complain," she said, barely bothering to meet his eyes, "your words will fall on exactly the same deaf ears as last time, and the time before. We operate these search turbines for the greater benefit of Panoply, not for your personal convenience. Your queries are scheduled into the task queue just like everyone else's." "I haven't come to complain, Vanessa." Dreyfus eased into the vacant chair next to Lara. She sat at a hooded console, next to a slanted, floor-to-ceiling window, looking out over the turbine hall where the towering data retrieval machines spun in their glass tubes. A handful of technicians were down in the hall, carrying compads and moving between the tree-sized tubes with expressions of almost monkish servitude. It was as if the tending of the fearsome turbines was the last and most sacred calling of their lives.
"That's a development. Are you feeling well, Dreyfus?"
She reached out and placed a hand on his brow.
"Not feverish? Not been working too hard lately?"
He pushed her hand away gently. Internal Prefect Lara had assumed her position as head of archives shortly after the death of her predecessor, Nestor Trajanova. As far as Dreyfus was aware, Lara had never had any contact with Trajanova prior to this assignment, since she had been working in an entirely different section of Panoply, under a separate chain of command. But by some curious osmosis, Lara appeared to have gained all of Trajanova's working habits, including a general disdain for anyone who demanded her services without ample justification, and a personal animus reserved specifically for Dreyfus himself, perhaps because he was often in the habit of making vague or poorly constrained information retrieval requests. Dreyfus was forced to tolerate these quirks, because Lauer had also inherited Trajanova's supreme attention to detail, as well as a deep understanding of the search turbine architecture. "I want you to run the query again," he said patiently. "I could push it through myself, but we both know that you're much better at formulating this sort of thing than I am."
"I've had a lot of practice with the demands you make on us."
"Each of us has our part to play, Vanessa," he said soothingly. "You're right that the turbines need to be used fairly and efficiently. That's why I'd rather not clog them up with poorly formed search parameters." Something pinched in her face.
"And in what way is running this query going to benefit any of us,
when it's come up blank on every previous occasion?" "There are more dead now. Somewhere in that mass of new information may be the common factor we missed before."
"There isn't one. We've been over it."
"It's not a cut-and-dried link I'm after, just a common predisposition. A propensity, you might call it."
"The one that Eng brought back, Case 54. He didn't fit your theory very well, did he?"
"There'll always be outliers, or types of risk we don't recognize at face value. That's why I'd like you to expand the terms of reference this time. I know it'll be costly in terms of search time, which is why I'm not asking lightly."
"Demanding lightly, you mean?"
His smile grew strained. It was an old, slightly tedious game, but they both understood the rules by now. "Go beyond the obvious this time, Vanessa. I'm interested in an addiction to risk in all its facets, from dangerous sports to serial infidelity, to reckless speculation on the stock markets. Can you do that for me?" She sneered away his question.
"Just for once you might bring me an actual challenge."
Dreyfus allowed himself a smile. "You know, there are days when I almost miss Nestor Trajanova. Almost. Do they put something in your coffee down in archives?" Lara grunted something in reply. Blanking him, she turned her full attention to the console. Her nails hammered on keys, shaping the symbolic chains that would direct the turbines. Dreyfus turned his eyes to the hall, where the technician still moved. Beneath his feet, the floor thrummed with the powerful threshing of machines. Aumonier was in the tactical room when the next death happened. It was mid-morning by Panoply time, and they were working through the normal caseload, things unconnected with Wildfire or Devon Garland. Small-scale polling irregularities, scheduled core upgrades, lockdown reviews, matters of internal discipline and promotion, training and recruitment, material procurement. This was the common grind of Aumonier's work, and she found none of it boring. 11 years under the Scarab had seen to that. She had crushed the very concept of boredom eradicated it from the range of mental states she was capable of experiencing. It was the clockmaker's one gift to her. A young female analyst was just going over the numbers for new whip-hound orders when a chime sounded from the table before her. "Incoming call request from Chasm City," the analyst said. "It's Hestia Delmar, Supreme Prefect."
"I thought I told her to call back next week."
"You did, ma'am,"
the analyst said, hesitating.
"And it's next week."
Omanier sighed.
"Put her on."
The analyst closed any tactically sensitive displays on the walls and table while the solid orrery defaulted to its baseline configuration. Hestia Delmar's face appeared on the wall opposite Omanier, requiring the prefects and analysts on the other side of the table to swivel around in their high-backed chairs.
"Detective Marshal Delmar,"
Omanier said, politely enough, but without much warmth.
"How good of you to remember our arrangement."
"I'm just glad I caught you, Supreme Prefect. For some reason I've been unlucky in the past, always managing to call when you're otherwise engaged."
Omanier smiled with excessive sweetness.
"Work presses on us both, I'm sure. How may I finally be of help?"
"I thought the terms of my request were already clear, Supreme Prefect. I wish to discuss intelligence sharing between our two agencies."
Hestia Delmar was a curly-haired, broad-faced woman, with a humorless demeanour and a severe attachment to her work. It had taken Omanier a little while to pin down why she found her so intensely irritating. They were alike.
"We have perfectly workable arrangements already in place, Detective Marshal. The formal channels have served us well enough in the past, haven't they?"
"As I don't need to remind you, Supreme Prefect, these are different times. Nervous times, I don't mind saying."
"Oh, dear. Is there trouble in Chasm City?"
"There's trouble everywhere, as I don't doubt you're aware. The breakaway movement, citizen unrest, heightened tension between the orbital communities and the Ultras, doubts over the efficacy of Panoply's security provision."
"Our worries? Not yours, I'd say."
"Instability in the Glitter Band affects all of us, Supreme Prefect. Our trading arrangements go back a century and a half. Can you imagine how concerned we are with the orbital community threatening to tear itself apart? Yellowstone's economy may be robust, but we're not immune to jitters."
"If it's just jitters, I'd say we have nothing to fear."
"Perhaps not now, but who can say what lies ahead? The formal channels are too slow, Supreme Prefect. Our agencies must be able to share intelligence just as speedily as the physical movement of individuals, if not faster."
Omanier's face tightened.
"If and when we have need of that sort of intelligence sharing, Detective Marshal,
I'm sure our respective organizations will rise to the challenge. Unless there's some particular difficulty that I can help you with immediately." "I'd hate to put you to any trouble, Supreme Prefect, knowing how busy you are." "No trouble at all, Detective Marshal. How may I be of assistance? Is it about the tax irregularity business you wanted me to look into? The orbital holdings you were concerned about?"
"No, I've given up on that.
Perhaps in a year or five, when you aren't so preoccupied, you might be able to spare someone to check on the status of those rots. But that isn't my highest priority right now."
Omanier pushed aside the twinge of guilt that she was undoubtedly meant to feel.
"So what would be, Detective Marshal?"
"We've lost track of three persons of interest, three fugitives, connected to a known criminal syndicate. Insurance fraud, insider trading, that sort of thing. They may have used false identities to leave Chasm City."
Omanier deployed a sympathetic look.
"How unfortunate for you."
"It would be useful to us if we could pinpoint their movements and activities while they were off-world. It might give us a lead on their present whereabouts."
"I must remind you that we don't retain exhaustive records of all citizen movements, Detective Marshal,"
Omanier said regretfully.
"Under the common articles, such information must be discarded after 10 years, unless a citizen quorum deems it pertinent to an ongoing inquiry."
"You're a police officer, Supreme Prefect.
We might wear different uniforms and operate under different codes, but at heart we're both upholders of the law. Your point being, you and I both know you wouldn't discard that information without a fight.
Panoply has its private archives, doesn't it? Those search turbines of yours. Don't tell me you don't keep a backup record of citizen movements, just in case it relates to a breaking case.
I am obligated to the common articles, Detective Marshall. Please don't suggest I'd take those obligations lightly. We are the servants of democracy, not its masters.
Eloquent words, Supreme Prefect, but you can do me this one favour. See what you have on my fugitives. Any movements, any priors. Their names are as follows.
There was another chime from the table. The tone was distinctly different this time, though. Aumonier held her composure, even as the atmosphere in the room shifted. As Lillian Beaudry looked down at the status update, her face clouded at the arrival of sudden and unwelcome news. Aumonier wondered if Hestia Delmar noticed the change.
"You must forgive me, Detective Marshall. A matter of some urgency has just come up." "I've waited a whole week, Supreme Prefect. Can you not spare me even a couple of minutes of your precious time?"
"Not personally, Detective Marshall. I'm sure you understand. Perhaps if you submitted your query through the usual channels?"
"The usual channels have got me precisely nowhere, Supreme Prefect. My requests are politely logged, and then very politely ignored. That's why I've tried to go all the way to the top, for all the good it's done me."
Beaudry grimaced, her eyes conveying various shades of bad news.
"You have my apologies, Detective Marshall. It's just... I know there's always an 'it's just' with you people. One day the tables will turn, you realize, and you'll be the one banging your head against bureaucratic walls."
Aumonier turned to the young female analyst.
"Jamal, I'm going to hand this call over to you now. Speak to Detective Marshall Delmar and make a note of her requests. Use your discretionary authority to assign resources as appropriate, with a note that you have my backing."
She returned her attention to her opposite number in Chasm City, offering a smile and hoping it might be reciprocated.
"Jamal will do all she can, within reason, Detective Marshall. You can't ask for more than that."
"I still have the feeling I'm being fobbed off, Supreme Prefect,"
Hestia Delmar said, resolutely maintaining her stony expression.
"Still, it's marginally better than the blank indifference I've received so far. I suppose I should count my blessings."
"We are all trying to do our best,"
Aumonier said.
"We are. It's just that some of us are doing a better job of it than others."
The face on the wall vanished as Jamal continued the conversation on her compad, using earphones to keep the conversation low. Glass privacy baffles rose out of the table, framing Jamal from either side, so there was no chance of the detective marshal picking up any part of the ordinary discussion going on in the tactical room. After a moment, Aumonier swiveled her seat, facing the solid orrery at the end of the room, and gave a nod to Lillian Beaudry.
"Let me guess. Threshold triggers picked up another wildfire event,"
Beaudry said.
"Pictures still firming up, but it looks clear-cut to me."
The solid orrery returned to its prior condition, showing both the breakaway habitats and the 54 locations where the wildfire had struck. The relevant habitats elevated above the glitter band on fine glowing threads. But now a 55th habitat was rising, oozing upwards, swelling from a pinprick as quick matter organized itself into a physical representation of the structure. It was a wheel, a cog-shaped world with a hub, spokes, and a torus of habitable space wrapped around its rim. Aumonier did not immediately recognize it. Her knowledge of the habitats was exemplary, but there were several hundred that fitted this basic configuration, and dozens in approximately the right orbit.
"What is that place?"
she asked.
"Carousel Addison Lovelace," said Beaudry, heavy-lidded eyes scanning a readout. "Current status? Unoccupied."
"Someone's died there,"
Aumonier said.
"That doesn't fit my definition of unoccupied."
"Just a moment."
Beaudry was speed-reading.
"Addison Lovelace was mothballed 20 years ago, just after the recession of 09. Seems an eco-collapse took hold and they didn't have the capital reserves to fix the problems. The habitat was declared bankrupt, then sold off to asset strippers. All citizens relocated, only a few thousand, and then the whole place depressurized and cleared for redevelopment."
"A few thousand isn't many for a place that large,"
Aumonier mused, feeling she must be missing something.
All right. What do we know about the death?
It started about 23 minutes ago,
Beaudry said.
Triggers flagged a spike in medical queries from the vicinity of Addison Lovelace.
Aumonier frowned slightly.
The vicinity? Not the place itself?
Construction and reclamation workers, Jane, floating in free space near the wheel, or working on its outside? Something happening to one of the workers? Some kind of fit or seizure?
Why am I only hearing about it now?
It was still ambiguous. It took the other workers some time to get their colleague back into a pressurized shack, which is when the character of the query shifted and began to strongly correlate with a wildfire event. 3 minutes ago, the triggers exceeded the detection threshold.
Beaudry drew breath.
The deceased citizen appears to be one Terzet Friller. No known priors?
As the senior prefect spoke, a biographical snapshot began to assemble on the wall. A face, a name, the bare bones of a life. Just another citizen of the Glitter Band, one among 100 million. Some poor soul who until this moment had never been of the slightest interest to either Panoply or Jane Aumonier.
Run the projections again.
Next to the face appeared the familiar graph of deaths against time, plotted through with the rising curves of the best guess mathematical models. Now there were 55 data points, instead of 54. Aumonier knew the projections off by heart by now, and she was relieved to see the addition of Terzet Friller to the toll of dead did not lead to any significant change in the long-term predictions. Not exactly good news, she thought, but not bad news either.
"I assume the brain will be too cooked to give us much," she said. "But Demikov ought to get a look at it anyway. Do we have any assets close enough to be useful?"
"Not within an hour," Beaudry said, studying a complex, scribble-like plot of operatives, ships, orbits, and possible inter-habitat trajectories. "We can have a heavy medical squad on site within 3, if they're tasked and dispatched immediately."
"Eng's already out there, isn't she?"
Beaudry nodded.
"Confirmed on site at the Shigamint spindle as of 30 minutes ago. Contact established with local constables, and now making her way to the Brunner residence."
Aumonier turned to the solid orrery. The Shigamint spindle and Carousel Addison Lovelace were in different orbits of the Glitter Band, but by chance both were presently within the same quadrant, on the far side of Yellowstone from Panoply.
"Bankal and Eng already have pangolin clearance. No sense in involving non-cleared prefects when we already have 2 cleared assets in the field."
"We could retask Eng?"
Beaudry suggested.
"No,"
Aumonier said carefully, balancing the priorities.
"Let her collect the widow first, then the victim."
Then she turned back to the analyst, who was just concluding her call with the detective marshal.
"Follow up her request, Jemal. But when I say use your discretion..."
"You want me to assist her, but not at the expense of diverting resources from wildfire, ma'am."
"You understand me perfectly,"
Aumonier said. Talia rubbed her hand along the parapet's pleasingly rough texture, shooing away a dull-eyed pigeon that was in no hurry to leave. They were walking along a balcony that fronted a long row of sleepy, whitewashed residences, built back into the rising slope of an artificial hillside. On the other side of the parapet, the land fell away along the curving geometry of the cylinder-shaped habitat, with towns, lakes, and woodland dwindling into blue-green haze.
"This is the sort of place my father said he'd like to retire to,"
Talia said to Sparva.
"He said he wanted somewhere where he could practice his watercolours, and it was no use if the view changed every time someone sneezed. I never really understood what he meant back then."
"And now?"
"I'm starting to get it, although maybe I'm just getting older."
"Word to the wise," Sparva said in a confiding tone. "Never tell a pig you're feeling old. You won't get much in the way of sympathy, given our average life expectancy." "You understand it, though, don't you? I think we're all the same, deep down, all of us in Panoply. We like quiet, stillness, stasis of a change. The rest of society's on some sort of headlong rush to explore every possible way of living, and we're the brakes, the anchors, stopping it from whirling out of control. That's what my father understood all those years ago."
She kept sliding her hand along the parapet as they walked, feeling its cool integrity under her skin, not even minding the occasional smear of sun-baked pigeon shit. He'd have liked it here, if he'd ever got the chance to retire.
Maybe it would have suited him, Sparva said, but I'll say this. It's not the kind of place Dreyfus was hoping to associate with Victim 54.
It isn't.
Look at it, Tal. Nice stone houses, nice stone walls, nice parks and lakes, pleasant weather, everything tidy and respectable and a bit tedious and safe for most tastes.
Why would that make a difference?
Dreyfus reckons there's a strain of risk-taking among the dead. A propensity, he calls it.
And what do you think?
Sparva walked on thoughtfully.
I might have believed there was something in it, at least for a while.
Instinct had Talia lowering her voice while they spoke of such a sensitive matter. But they were safe enough in the Shiga Mint Spindle, where a stone was just a stone and the walls very definitely did not have ears. It was one of the least surveilled habitats in the Glitter Band.
Might have?
She asked.
The first case, Cassandra Lang, died while she was playing lava hopscotch in the Colfax Orb. She was a professional gamer, regularly gambled with her own life. Some of the others fit the pattern, too. Not just risk-takers in that sense, but across the field, from con artists to rash investors to serial philanderers. The trouble is, where do you draw the line? Breathing's a risk, and some of the dead don't fit the pattern at all.
But you think, or thought, that there might have been something in it.
54 was the nail in the coffin, though. We've both seen the background documents, Tal. There's nothing about Antal Bronner that fits Dreyfus's theory, and the fact that he chose to live here, of all places.
Not the sort of place to suit a risk-taker, is that what you're saying?
Not unless you have a deep phobia of pigeons.
They were nearly at the Bronner dwelling. Talia was surprised not to see a presence outside the home. Upon docking, they had liaised with the local constables at the hub, politely declining the offer of an escort to the housing development. They had been told that constables would meet them at the household, where they were providing Giselin Bronner with the additional security she had seemed to think necessary.
"We've got the right address, haven't we?"
she started saying, just as her bracelet chimed. She touched her throat microphone, said, "Eng," and listened through her earpiece to the supernumerary analyst on the other end, who was relaying orders directly from the tactical room. She acknowledged the call, then closed the link.
"Going to let me in on the secret?" Sparva asked.
"There's been another death. When we've collected Giselin Bronner, we're to make a detour on our way back to Panoply and recover the body."
"Body?
Not just the head?"
"That's what they told me."
They stopped at the entrance. The front door was set back into a cool, shaded porch, and the door itself was slightly ajar. Talia straightened the hem of her tunic, ran a hand across her brow to fuss her hair into shape, then knocked on the door. When no one answered after half a minute, she knocked again, then waited the same length of time before glancing at Sparva. Sparva reached in and pushed at the door. It creaked as it swung wider. When it was halfway open, Talia called into the gloom beyond.
"Constables? Madame Bronner, this is Prefect Eng. The constables at the hub said we'd be expected."
There was still no answer, so Talia stepped into the dwelling. A vague unease had her hand moving for her whip hound, but she resisted the impulse to unclip the weapon, not wishing to seem jittery in front of Sparva.
"Giselin?"
she called out, louder this time, her voice booming back at her from the rounded masonry of the interior. Her eyes were adjusting to the light inside the dwelling, and it was airier than it had seemed only a few minutes earlier. Beyond the reception area where she now stood, arched passageways led off into a series of rounded chambers, cutting back into the hillside. The reception area was austere in its furnishings and decoration. The walls were a textured white, set with alcoves and projecting ledges, but there were no pictures and only a few minimalist ornaments. Natural daylight came down through ceiling ducts. She touched her microphone.
"This is Eng. Prefect Bankal and I have entered the Bronner residence, but there's no one to welcome us. Proceeding further."
They moved from the reception room into an adjoining chamber. It was a sort of lounge or dining room, with stone chairs around a low stone table. Again, there were alcoves, containing skeletal white candelabra. A fluted glass vase had toppled onto the table, flowers hanging limply over the table's edge, a puddle of water contained from spreading by its own surface tension. Something was off. The rooms were devoid of clutter or careless ornamentation. The person who lived here would not have allowed that untidy mishap to sit unattended for long. Talia directed a wary look at Sparva. Sparva gave a nod, then unclipped his whip hand. He flicked out the filament and spoke softly. "Rapid search mode? Observe and report only?" The whip hound nodded its red-eyed head, then slinked through an archway into the next chamber. They walked on into the next room, while the whip hound moved further into the residence. "Giselin?" Talia called again, the timbre of her own voice shifting. Now they were deeper into the property. "It's Panoply. We've come to talk to you about Antal." They moved through a parlour, then a bare room with bedrooms and bathrooms branching off it. The whiphound was just coming out of one of these rooms. It raced further into the property, with nothing yet to report. There were no windows, not once they had moved away from the front of the dwelling, but the ceiling ducts maintained the airy ambience of the earlier rooms. "There's been a communication scrub," Talia said. "She must have gone out, and the constables went with her." "She left her front door half open. Who does that, when they've already asked for additional protection?" The whiphound came back. It halted, keeping its head level, its red eye sweeping back and forth between them. "It wants us to follow," Sparva said. Chapter 4 It was a public transmission, distributed by expensive, if entirely legal, means, broadcast across 1,000 media fronts. Within a few seconds, the maximum light travel time for even the most knotted signal routing within the glitter band, it would have been seen and heard in 1,000 habitats, maybe more. The face loomed large, in interior mental visualizations, on private screens and private walls, in the gene-tweaked flesh of hands, on the backs of lovers, on the soaring display surfaces of civic plazas and recreation spaces, in the curtaining spray of fountains and waterfalls, lasered onto individual droplets of water, every channel that was available, and not blocked from displaying this paid transmission, now showed the face. From the head of curls to the unlined, cherubic features, to the neat vertical nick of a scar under the right eye, it was the face Dreyfus had seen firsthand. "Good people, good citizens," the face said. "I won't take your time. We all have lives to be getting on with. Most of us do, at any rate. You know me by now, and if you don't yet know me, then I trust we'll consider ourselves friends before very long. I'm Devon Garlin, and there are things they would rather I didn't tell you." The face flashed a smile, vertical lines bracketing either side of Garland's mouth. "They don't trust us, you see. They don't trust us to trust them. And after the mess they made of things 2 years ago, it's not hard to see why. They've been praying they won't be tested again, knowing full well how lucky they were the first time. But something's in the air, friends." He lowered his voice confidingly. "Nothing official yet. And nothing you'll have seen or heard on any of the public nets, but rumour slips through the mesh. Have you heard anything lately, that there's something building? Something they can't stop?" Dreyfus watched the transmission as it played across one of the walls near the refectory, displayed as a matter of routine simply because it had been identified as a high-reach broadcast of natural interest to Panoply. He bristled, sweat prickling under his collar. It was hard not to read a mocking glint in the arctic blue eyes of Garland's eyes, as if he knew Dreyfus would be listening. "People are dying," Garland said. "A few dozen so far, a few drops in the ocean. But the numbers are going up, and they don't know what's causing it. They're trying very hard not to let this become public knowledge. But word is spreading. Concerned citizens, witnesses, medical personnel... These people won't be silenced just to suit Panoply, and nor should you. As I said, it's all just rumour, for now. Perhaps there's nothing in it, and we can all sleep safely in our beds. But if you hear of a death that happened suddenly, or if you see prefects behaving oddly, going about their business more furtively than usual, if such a thing is possible, then take a moment to ask yourselves this. What's the point of a security organization that cannot give us protection when we most have need of it? Dreyfus became aware of a presence at his side. He glanced away from the transmission. It was Jane Aumônier, hands behind her back, chin lifted, absorbing the words with a look of stoic acceptance. The light from Garland's face brushed a delicate edge onto her profile. Dreyfus watched her for a few seconds, then turned back to the wall. Neither of them spoke as the statement continued. Whatever becomes of this worry, they'd rather we didn't know about. There is another way. Spurn the false assurances of the prefects. Shun the promises they can't keep, the trust they can't uphold, and find a common security outside the hide-bound framework of Banablay. 8 habitats have already thrown aside their shackles and discovered that there is life and security beyond the old moribund institutions. More are poised to follow. Soon it will be a flood. The prefects will tell you we're damaging the glorious integrity of the Glitter Band. But that isn't true at all. What the Glitter Band is, and what it could be, are 2 different things. But to make a better world, we first have to take back control of what was always ours. Garlin extended an open, beckoning hand, and that smile creased his face again. Good people, good citizens, join us, and turn your faces to the light. The transmission finished, the wall darkening, but Dreyfus could still feel the lingering presence of that face, as if it had imprinted itself on Panoply's very fabric. Good people, good citizens, he said, sneering out the words. I'd like to ram those sentiments down. It's an act of provocation, Aumônier said levelly, and we won't allow ourselves to be provoked, will we? We might not like it, but he's broken no rules by issuing this statement. What about inciting public unrest? By saying there are rumours? I'm afraid that's not presently a crime. Dreyfus pointed a finger at the now blank wall. How does he know? How did Devon Garlin get to be so well informed? I can see where that thought's leading. You are not going to put him in the frame as the cause of these incidents. Dreyfus waited a moment before answering. You can't deny they're working well for him. Making him a lucky opportunist. A man who knows when fate's handed him an advantage. That's all. If you say so. You have a grudge against him, a personal one after what happened in Stonehollow. Maybe you don't like the thought of the wealth and privilege that spawned him either, but it's no crime to be born into an influential family. Letting him get under your skin is exactly what he wants, exactly what he's hoping for, prodding us into an overreaction, making it seem as if he's got us rattled. Dreyfus forced himself to nod, seeing the truth in her argument, even as his blood boiled against her reasoned, sensible tone. I don't like demagogues, he said. So I've heard, Aumônier said. Talia took a careful look at the body. The whip-hound had brought them to a fallen constable, slumped on the floor with a stun truncheon just out of reach of one outstretched hand. The constable was a red-headed woman, wearing mustard-coloured tunic and trousers, only her burgundy armband and equipment belt marking her active assignment to the citizen constabulary.
"She's breathing," Talia said.
Kneeling now, she shifted the woman's posture into the recovery position, making sure her airway was unobstructed. Sparva called from the room next door.
There's another one here, also out cold.
Talia brushed the woman's hair from her eyes.
Signs of injury? No bruising, no sign of a struggle.
Talia unclipped her whiphound and deployed its filament.
Maximum alert, she said,
before touching her throat microphone.
Eng again.
We've found two constables, unconscious but breathing. Looks as if they've been knocked out by something, possibly some sort of anesthetic weapon. Request immediate assistance, including a light medical squad.
She listened to the response with a sinking heart. Even with an emergency intervention, no other panoply unit could be with them for at least 2 hours, and that was an optimistic estimate.
They can't wait that long, she replied. See if you can get through to the constables at the hub and tell them to mobilize local medical services. Tal, Sparva called, you need to see this.
Knowing she had done all she could for the fallen constable, she pushed up from the ground.
What? You'd better come. You know how I am with faces.
Talia moved towards his voice with trepidation, her whip-hound slinking after her. She stepped around the second fallen constable, a shaven-headed Neutrois citizen dressed in a yellow gown, with the same belt and burgundy armband as their colleague. Sparva had already gone through into the next room, where he was standing with his back to her, arms folded while he inspected the scene before him.
It's Ghislain Bronner, Talia said.
What I thought. I wouldn't get too close, though, until we know she isn't booby-trapped. Ghislain Bronner was sitting upright in one of her own chairs, facing Sparva and Talia. She had been tied to the chair by her waist and arms, and her legs had been bound together just above the ankles. She was clothed, wearing a high-collared red dress, but the fabric of the right sleeve had been hacked or torn away to expose her forearm. Fixed to it was an apparatus like an overly ornate wristwatch. She was gagged, her face slumped down into her chest, her eyes closed. Talia stepped closer, warily. The woman looked dead, but it was the device attached to her arm that most concerned her. The watch face was a battery of glass vials, arranged in a radial fashion. Little alloy plungers had already pushed out the contents of a couple of them.
"You seen anything like that before, Sparva?"
Talia asked, wondering if it might be a bomb or an anti-tamper device. Sparva seemed oddly reticent.
"The evidence archive? Once or twice?" "You're going to enlighten me?"
"It's a pain flower, an interrogation machine. There's a little clockwork timer in the base, and it delivers escalating doses in sequence.
What the hell is such a nasty thing doing here?"
"I almost hate to speculate. It's black market technology, imported from Sky's Edge. Homemade torture tech from the murkier fringes of the war. When the Ultras have a score to settle, this is one of their preferred methods." There was a little click, and a mechanical buzzing. The third plunger in sequence had begun to depress into its vial. Talia and Sparva watched, both of them taken aback that the device was still operating. Ghislain Bronner jolted awake, her head snapping back as if it had been yanked by a cord. Her arms flexed and tensed, and her back arched against the chair. Her eyes bulged. A sound came from her mouth, muffled by the gag. Her head twisted, eyes fixing on Talia. Some wild, terrified acknowledgement flashing between them.
"It's all right," Talia said. "We'll get it off you."
Putting aside any concerns that there might still be a booby trap, she moved to Bronner's side and loosened the gag. Bronner drew breath, her eyes still meeting Talia's, and then she gave out a terrible, rising moan. Talia squeezed her hand.
"Sparva, can we get the pain flower off without making things worse?"
"Depends," Sparva said. He looked at Talia, then at the woman, as if unsure how candid he could be.
"Sometimes there's an anti-tamper trigger. A terminal dose."
Ghislain Bronner stopped moaning. She breathed in and out, each breath heavier than the last. Then her jaw clenched tight. She said,
"Get it off me. I don't care."
Sparva put out a hand and summoned his whip-hound. It jumped into his grip, retracting its filament with a clean snap.
"Sword mode,"
Sparva said. 5-centimeter blade, anesthetic edge." His whip-hound pushed out a bright, stiff line. He leaned over Bronner.
"I'm going to cut it off. I'll be as careful as I can, but it would still be best if you didn't flinch." "Do it,"
she said, before biting down on the pain. Something clattered in the adjoining room. Talia twisted around. The Neutrois citizen in the yellow gown was still exactly where Talia had stepped over them. She looked back at Sparva, then Bronner.
He's still here,
Bronner said. Tullia summoned her whiphound, retracting the filament but holding it in her hand, rather than clipping it to her belt.
Stay with her,
she told Sparva.
Tull,
Sparva began. She was already turning, already on her way out of the room, in the direction of the noise. They had already swept this part of the property, she told herself. If there had been someone present besides the constables and Giselin Bronner, the whiphounds would have picked up on it. But something was leaving the room. She saw the ornament they had stumbled against, a larger version of the white candelabra, now lying on the floor. It was skeletal, with a narrow trunk and bony arm supporting spherical candle holders. The fleeing figure was a human form, but sketched out of mismatched edges and shadows, very nearly invisible, except when it moved.
Stop!
Tullia called out. You are under panoply, observants! I have authorization to use lethal force! The figure hesitated, looking back at her, a man-shaped collage of mirrors and prisms.
Not your problem, Prefect.
She deployed the whiphound's filament, allowed it to form a traction spool, and then let go. Mark and acquire, she ordered, but the whiphound kept sweeping its head in a scan pattern, trying and failing to lock on to the subject.
Camelioflage,
Tullia realized. The man must have realized that this was his chance. He moved more quickly now, striding over a low table, ducking under an archway and bounding towards the front door.
Here,
she said angrily, snatching the whiphound, retracting its filament and snapping it to her belt. Perhaps it would have a better chance at subject acquisition in daylight. The front door creaked open. Tullia sprinted back through the rooms after the man, skipping over the first fallen constable. By the time she reached the reception area, the door was wide open. She bounded out onto the balcony, momentarily dazzled by the brightness of day. She looked left and right, certain the fleeing man would not have had time to reach either end of the balcony. But there was something, she realized, a sort of clotted smokiness against the air above the parapet to her left, where there ought only to have been a view of distant, rising terrain. She squinted, forcing her eyes to make some sense of the confusing impression. The fleeing man was on the parapet, crouching as he tried to lower himself over the wall, down to the level below. He was only 20 paces away.
Stop! She called again. No further warnings. I will use lethal force. Use it, Prefect,
the man called back, lowering further so only his head and upper torso were visible over the parapet. Tullia jogged after him, redeploying the whiphound once again.
Mark and acquire,
she said, but this time holding the handle to concentrate its scan. She felt it twist in her grip, signalling acquisition. But the man was stretching lower, barely any part of him now visible. She hurled the whiphound, shouting,
Detain!
As she did, and prayed she had not made matters worse. The man slipped out of view. The whiphound landed next to the parapet, flicking out its traction spool at the last moment to cushion and orientate itself, and in another instant it was slithering over the wall. Tullia bounded after it. The man was below, sprawled on the ground, the whiphound wrapping its filament around his legs, taking care to keep the sharpened edge away from any physical contact with its subject. The man was struggling, trying to claw himself along, but his efforts were futile. His camelioflage outfit was starting to malfunction, blocky areas of it showing the wrong color and background, so that it looked like a restlessly changing harlequin pattern. He had been wearing a full-length gown, with a narrow slitted hood drawn tight over a pair of goggles.
Don't fight it, she advised. I'm coming down to you. Take your time,
a hoarse voice said, a hand touching her wrist gently.
You can have him later. I understand that he's your concern, not mine, but we do have some unfinished business.
It was the female constable, the one Tullia had assumed was out cold. Tullia appraised the red-haired woman, looking at her eyes for signs of concussion or a brain bleed, and seeing only stubborn focus and an eagerness to be getting on with her duties.
Do you remember what happened? A man came to the house, forced his way in. After that, nothing.
He got to Giselin Bronner. She's alive, but in a pretty bad way. I've asked Panoply to alert your people and let them know medical help is needed. But if there's anything you can do to speed things up...
The woman's hand tightened on the haft of her stun truncheon.
What did the bastard do to her?
Fixed some interrogation device to her. My deputy's in there trying to get it off.
Talia nodded over the wall, to the level below.
But he's our concern now. How is Dane?
Talia realized she must mean the other constable.
Out cold, like you were. But I think he'll be all right.
The woman gave Talia a look that was just as long and appraising as the one she had received from Talia. She nodded slowly.
All right, Prefect. Since you asked nicely, the fucker's yours. I'll make sure the medics are alerted. Thank you. What's your name, by the way? Trelon. Take this, Prefect.
Trelon offered Talia the stun truncheon, armed now, its blunt end giving off a dancing blue spark and a sharp ozone tang. Talia nodded her thanks, took the stun truncheon, went to the end of the balcony, down the connecting stairs to the lower level, and then backtracked until she reached the man. The whiphound was still holding him. A handful of citizens had begun to drift out of their homes, gathering along the balcony to see what was happening. They were all keeping a sensible distance from the detained man, and all of them edged briskly aside as Talia passed, the truncheon crackling in her hand. "Nothing to see here, citizens," she said, knowing how little good it would do. She knelt next to the man, extended her free hand and tugged his cloak looser, so she could see more of what was under it. He wore a tight black outfit sewn with many pockets and loops. He was very skinny, young-looking, hairless, and the goggles were jammed so tightly over his eyes they seemed to be part of him.
"Who are you?"
she asked, softly at first.
"None of your concern, Prefect.
Ultras sent you.
What was your interest in Giselin Bronner?"
The man bared his teeth, grinning at her.
"What's your interest?"
Talia considered the stun truncheon. It felt heavy and dependable in her hand, and she had no doubt it would be an unpleasant thing to be touched by that dancing, crackling spark. She set the truncheon aside, then spoke into her collar.
"Eng, I have detained a subject near the Bronner residence. Medical assistance has been requested from local authorities. I'll remain with the subject until Prefect Bankal is available to assist me with moving the subject to our vehicle."
She paused, swallowed, and added,
"Unless there are further instructions, I will continue with my agreed duties when we leave the Shiga Mince Spindle."
She closed the link. The subject wriggled under the whiphound's embrace, and the whiphound tightened its hold, its single red eye fixed on him with malevolent intensity.
"You could hurt me, Prefect. Why don't you?"
"Because you want it,"
Talia said. Aumanier closed the doors to the tactical room and turned to face the gathered prefects and analysts. Almost without thinking, she studied their faces and postures for signs of fatigue, looking for anyone who might be pushing themselves past the point of effectiveness. They had all been working harder than usual these recent weeks, as the crisis bit deeper. Red eyes, poor complexions, slack muscle tone, and flashes of irritability were almost a given now. What concerned her was the traces of more extreme tiredness, such as forgetfulness, bursts of microsleep, however artfully concealed, and a general fading of operational focus, leading to the risk of suboptimal or even dangerously incorrect decision processes. The older hands, such as Clear Mountain and Beaudry, were rarely the subject of her interest. They knew their own limits by now, and they also knew it was worse than futile to attempt to match Jane or Monnier's own working patterns. They were not like her. They would never be like her, because they were fortunate enough not to have been through the experience she had. But it was sometimes necessary to remind others, especially the newer entrants. Some of the truly foolish even tried to put in more hours than Aumanier, always trying to be first in the tactical room when she arrived, and still there when she left. They volunteered for extra duties, put in double shifts, covered for others with a too eager enthusiasm. They meant well, but it was a shortcut to burnout and operational ineffectiveness. Sometimes it only took a quiet word to put them right.
"You're not me,"
she would explain to them. "Be grateful for that, and enjoy your dependence on sleep. It's your brain's chance to break out of linear thought patterns. Even asleep, you're doing useful work for Panoply." When that failed to do the trick, when the bags remained under the eyes, she had one other option open to her. She would take them to the office, the room she only rarely visited these days, the spherical chamber in an area of panoply where there was no artificial gravity, and where she had spent every second of those 11 years. She would point to the spot in the middle of the room where she had been obliged to float in weightlessness, safely distant from the walls or any visitors. When people had come to her in the office, they had been required to tie safe distance tethers to themselves, to prevent them drifting too close. "I'm the way I am because of what happened in this room," she would tell them. "Not because I'm strong, or better than you, or more dedicated to panoply. Not because I care about the glitter band more than you. It's because I'm damaged. Because the thing that happened to me in this room broke my mind, and all the king's horses couldn't put me back together again." If they got to that point, then some of them were foolish to think the lesson was over. It was not. "I'm going to leave you in here now," Aumônier would say, "for 26 hours. The room will be dark. You can't touch anything or speak to anyone. No one will visit you. You'll just float here, in the middle, alone. I have a feed from your biometric bracelet, though. It will tell me if you are awake or unconscious. If you fall asleep at any point in these 26 hours, even for an instant, a bout of microsleep, just the barest closing of your eyes, you will be dismissed. There will be no appeal, no disciplinary review. You will leave panoply." If there was a lie in that promise, it was a small one. She never let any of them spend more than 13 hours in the room. That was enough, more than sufficient to make her point. When she pulled them out, they would always swear that the time had been much longer than a day. "It wasn't. It was 13 hours, and you didn't manage to get through that without several episodes of microsleep. You're forgiven, though, because you're only human, and now you have some idea of what I went through. Only a small idea, though. You endured 13 hours, and if the scarab had been on you, you'd have died. I was in there for 8,000 times as long." She rarely had trouble with them after that. "How are we feeling?" she asked the room. "I want total honesty. Everyone wants to play their part, and that's to be respected. But I'd sooner one of you took a day away from Wildfire now and returned fresh than end up in a state of nervous collapse, where you're no use to me for weeks. Believe me, I respect hard work. But nothing impresses me more than admitting to our own limits and not being ashamed of them." She was standing, arms folded across her chest, facing her own empty chair across the table, Dreyfus to the right of it. "Well," a deafening silence. "And yet you all look like death warmed over, except for Tom, who looks like death warmed over twice. In which case I have some news for you all, just in case anyone was starting to think things couldn't get any more complicated. Have you all been briefed on what Eng and Bankar found in Shigamints?" The analyst next to Dreyfus glanced up. "Feeding through on all pangolin surfaces now, ma'am. I'll spare you the bother of reading." Aumônier walked around to the left of the table, skirting past the solid orrery. "Eng and Bankal have the Bronner widow, and she's out of immediate danger. But that's only because luck threw us a bone. Giselin Bronner was in the middle of being interrogated by an ultra-spy, using a chemical torture device. If Eng and Bankal had got there 20 minutes later, she'd have been dead." "A pain flower?" Dreyfus asked, pinching absently at the corner of an eye. "The interrogation instrument of choice? And it's not supposition that there's ultra-involvement. We have detained the agent." "Could we be dealing with a false flag operative?" asked Senior Prefect Miles Jaffner, squinting through narrow rectangular glasses at the summary feed appearing before him on the table. "To stir things up with the ultras?" Aumônier shook her head crisply as she took her place at the table. "I'd almost welcome such a transparent gambit, Miles. At least it would fit our previous case history of zero involvement with ultra elements. But it's no false flag. We've a known profile on the assailant. Tybald Grobno, a small-time dog's body for the ultras. A button boy, sent in to settle scores and eliminate unwanted competition. Grobno's the real deal, and we can backtrack his movements all the way to the parking swarm." Aumônier thought about the swarm, that ever-shifting cloud of ultra-starships. laying over in the Yellowstone system for trade, repairs, or merely the settling of ancient scores. Ultras were human, technically, but their motives were often deeply alien, and she never relished any overlap between her business and theirs. Life was complicated enough. "How the hell did an ultra-assassin get inside Shiga Mintz?" Dreyfus asked. "The usual chain of follies? Weak security screening at the hub? A plausible fake biography? Some moderately clever implant tampering to help him slip past routine scrutiny? We don't think the equipment came in with him. More than likely a previous operative had stashed the pain flower, the assassin goggles, and the camelioflage cloak at a safe location, inside Shiga Mintz's spindle." "Then by association," said Senior Prefect Mildred Dosso, pushing a loose lock of hair back under a clasp as she spoke, "we can figure the ultras for the death of Antal Bronner as well, and by implication the remaining wildfire cases." "Wouldn't that be lovely?" Aumonier said. "Then all we'd have to concern ourselves with is an implicit declaration of war against 100 million citizens." They all turned to look at the solid orrery, with its representation of the glitter band, and off to one side the tight pollen cloud of the parking swarm, lying in a high but not too distant orbit. None of them needed to be reminded of the potential destructive power of the ultra ships gathered in that swarm, or the tensions that had come to the boil in the past. "It doesn't fit," Dreyfus mused aloud. "Doesn't mesh. Ultras haven't figured in the other deaths. Why now?" "Perhaps they've only just slipped up," said Internal Prefect Claudette Sainte-Croix. "If there was a common factor linking these people, some reason for a systematic vendetta, we'd have picked up on it by now," Dreyfus said. "Besides, there was never a pain flower associated with the other deaths. Why would they switch from one method to another, just for the sake of the widow?" "We can't dismiss the connection just because it makes us uncomfortable," said Miles Jaffner. "I don't suggest that we do," Aumonier said. "But we won't assign undue significance to this incident until we know more about the Bronners. Maybe the widow will tell us something. Now she knows how close she came to dying." "And the Ultra?" Dreyfus asked. "Eng and Bankal are still best placed to investigate the Terzet Friller death at Addison Lovelace. They'll proceed there now, and leave Grobno under whip-hound detention at the Shiga Mintz spindle. When the heavy medical squad arrive for the widow, they can collect Grobno at the same time." "I'd like some time with him," Dreyfus said. "You'll get it," Aumonier replied. "But we'll tread carefully with this one, Tom. I've managed to keep the Ultras on our side for the last 2 years. I'd rather like to keep things that way." Sparva had done well with the whiphound, managing to get the pain flower off Giselin Bronner with only a few superficial cuts to show for the process. The local medics were with her now, assessing her condition and dressing the minor wounds and puncture points already inflicted on her by the Ultra device. She was still in a state of shock, eased into a chair in one of the adjoining rooms, while the medics fussed around her, clearly excited that they had been caught up in such an unusual incident.
"You've got the man?"
the widow asked.
"Yes, he's in our custody now. And under that camelioflage cloak, he's just a weedy boy with a few neural tweaks."
Talia had been over this once already, but Giselin Bronner evidently needed extra reassurance.
"We have the weapon he used on the constables. It was a stun pistol, very short range and not capable of killing anyone." "Are they going to be all right?"
"Dane and Trelon?"
"Yes.
They'll get over it. He only wanted to put them to sleep while he dealt with you."
Talia touched the woman's hand where it rested on the chair.
"That's where I end up with some awkward questions. According to my deputy..."
"The pig?"
"Yes."
Talia licked her lips, not really liking what she had heard in the woman's tone.
"According to my deputy, this has all the hallmarks of the Ultras settling a grievance. They couldn't get to you without getting past the constables, but the agent was obviously under orders to use minimum force in the process. You were the only target, in other words, and in light of what happened to your husband..."
"Which I still haven't been told about."
"There are some aspects of his death which are sensitive."
Talia was trying to offer sympathy, but the widow's manner was making it hard.
Let me turn it around, though, if you don't mind. You were the one who requested additional security measures. And look how well that worked. Something must have concerned you, Madame Brunner. You were told that your husband's death was a medical event, yet